Hey guys, this is Jordan. Before we hop into our episode today, many of you have asked us whether or not we're doing a TGFB event in Las Vegas this year before the big Bitcoin conference there. The answer is yes and no. While we're not going to be doing a full two-day conference in Vegas, we did decide to put on a private event for the TGFB community where we could also invite our friends who work in the Bitcoin industry who will be in town for the Bitcoin Magazine conference. So with that said, we are announcing the TGFB Las Vegas Friends and Family Barbecue, presented by Ridge Runner and the Highland Rim Sporting Club. You can join us on Tuesday, May 27th from noon to 4 p.m. for a private event featuring slow-cooked brisket, ribs, sides, cold drinks, and great company. Whether you're a longtime Bitcoiner or this is your first Bitcoin event, this is the perfect place and the perfect way to start the week. And because TGFB is about doing things right, every attendee will receive a numbered limited edition TGFB Las Vegas dog tag available only at this event. There are only 99 tickets available, and once they're gone, they're gone. So if you're going to be in Vegas and you want to come, you need to act now. Grab your ticket at tgfb.com/store or via the pinned tweet on the TGFB Twitter account. For the next week only, TGFB pod listeners can get 15% off their ticket by using promo code VEGAS15 at checkout. Buy yours today, and we'll see you in Vegas. Pastor C.R. Wiley, welcome to the Thank God for Bitcoin podcast.
Hey, Jordan. Glad to be with you.
It's good to have you. I guess this is just technically your first time on the podcast, but we've had you at different TGFB-affiliated things, so we're glad to have you back here. Why don't you just introduce yourself maybe for folks who aren't familiar with who you are?
Sure. I'm, as you noted, a pastor. I serve a church in the Portland, Oregon area. Actually, I'm on the Washington side of the river where sanity prevails, and in a town called Battleground, which is about as cool as the town's name. And I've written a number of books, and I've been a real estate investor, and I've been a professor of philosophy. I taught about for a decade, undergraduates. And I write for different publications like World Magazine and stuff like that.
Yeah, what's your role with them? You just took a role with them this past year, right?
Well, I'm just an editorialist, so whenever the mood strikes me, I send them stuff and then they publish it.
Okay. I can't remember. I think I heard there's somebody who took on a like more advisory role. I can't remember who it was. So the purpose of our podcast today, beyond just, you know, me thoroughly enjoying your company more generally, is that you shared this tweet. So I'm going to read this, you basically a series of tweets, actually. You said, this is probably February 7th. So we're recording early 2025. This is the tweet. I was involved in the poverty pimping game called, quote, economic development for about a decade. I have many stories that I'll share over the next few days. I rarely talk about this stuff, much too depressing, and no one is really interested in what works anyway. But it seems to be on everyone's mind right now, so maybe someone will get something out of my experiences and frustrations. Trigger warning, everything is a scam and nothing works. Tomorrow I'll begin to tell you why. So before we get into, obviously, you know, the fun part, which is getting into some of the details of that, why don't you just unpack for us how in the world, you know, you came to have that position and, you know, why you thought that was something you wanted to do at that point in your life?
Yeah, well, I didn't mention it when I introduced myself, mainly because it's kind of gone into the memory hole. But yeah, during the late 80s through much of the 90s, I was involved in urban ministry in Boston. And during those years, I was involved in, you know, quote, economic development. And, in terms of how I got, interested in that work or got into, urban ministry, I had, come from a home that was broken. I spent time in foster care and lived, as a ward of the state. So I had a period of life, during my teen years where, I was, you know, the object of concern for some folks, but, during that time, the thing that was transformative for me was my time at a little blue-collar church in Western Pennsylvania, where the people didn't think of themselves as social workers or development aid people. They just were regular folks who welcomed me into the church. And my friendship with the pastor's kid, a pastor's son, was the reason I was there. It wasn't because I was brought in because of some big outreach program, not even evangelistic in character, just he went to church because his father was a pastor, and so wanted to hang out with him and get out of the neighborhood too. So it wasn't anything that I wanted to kind of be associated with in any long term way. So I tried to get out of the neighborhood as much as I could, and so anyway, it was through the friendship and the mentoring and all the good stuff that happened in that little church that a major turnaround in my life occurred. And when I had a conviction that I was called into the ministry, I thought, well, maybe I should be involved in urban ministry since I understand that world. And yeah. it was sort of back in those days, they called it inner city ministry. That's not the hip term anymore, but that's what they used to call it. And I thought, well, I actually know what that world is like. And most of the people I see who are interested in it just don't have a clue. A lot of them were, kind of coming out of middle class
sure.
backgrounds and dealing with middle class guilt and listening to, we have different personalities today who preach radical discipleship, but we had a different bunch back then, like I said. And so there was a lot of guilt tripping. But I wasn't interested in it because of any kind of guilt tripping. I have no middle class guilt at all. I feel like that whole dynamic is counterproductive. Yeah. But anyway, so that's how I got into it. And for a short period of time, I even flirted with liberation theology just because it was the only theological approach that I was aware of that was addressing concerns related to poverty and economic development, stuff like that. But I didn't spend much time in that sort of intellectual space, mainly because I could see that most of it was BS. So I got out, and the reason I knew it was is because I had been an object of help, I guess you could say, by the professionals. The professionals. As a kid, I didn't like social workers. I didn't like psychologists. I didn't like all the people who were supposed to help me. I wanted to just stay away from them. So I have a kind of strong distaste for the professional classes that work in that world.
And what do you attribute that to? Was it just the way that, within your experience, the way that they made you feel or the way that they treated you or something along those lines? Or was it just something more general?
No, I think those things had a lot to do with it. I think good-hearted people get involved in those professions, but then it becomes just a job, and it becomes a kind of, and people... technically, they're not supposed to develop, relationships with people. That would be transference or whatever they call it these days. So you're just kind of in this mechanism that's supposed to address your needs or address the situation you find yourself in. Now, let me just separate a few things out. I do believe that relief is something that is needed when you have situations in which, families fall apart or communities are, natural disaster just devastates them, stuff like that.
Yeah.
But when we talk about development, we're talking about something different.
Yeah.
And how that actually happens isn't something that many of those institutions are really capable of pulling off.
Yeah. And I mean, how would you separate those two things? How would you define and understand, if you had somebody, again, we got people who, listen to this, and again, they're like, hey, I just want to help people.
Sure.
How would you kind of draw a line of distinction for somebody in that situation to kind of help them see actually there is a meaningful difference between those two things?
Well, when we think about relief, of course, if we think about, people starving, you'd go and you bring them food.
Yeah.
But everybody knows that that's not like a long-term, thing that you want to see, just never stop. You want to see people get back on their feet, and you want to see people taking care of themselves and so forth. And a lot of folks, they'll hear the old quip about teaching a man to fish, as opposed to giving them fish. And that's fine so far as it goes. But the question that they fail to ask themselves is, who knows how to fish?
Yeah.
does your typical development worker who's got kind of a left-wing kind of attitude and an ideological sort of, they've been captured ideologically, do they know how to fish? They don't know how to fish most of the time. And the people who do know how to fish are the people that they don't like. So people who are actually developing businesses, entrepreneurs and so forth, generally those folks are considered kind of deplorable by people in the world of, development. And sometimes you'll see, say second career guys who have been successful in business who get involved in quote development, and they don't last very long because they discover that no one really wants to know what they know.
They just drive them nuts, right? Like, they just realize how dysfunctional it is, and they're like, all right, I'll just go off and,
Right. Yeah, so yeah. In the world of development, basically, all the incentives are screwed up.
Mm. Yeah, so what would you, I can think of one example, right? So I never forget, they were talking about some of these homeless, trying to deal with homelessness in, like, San Francisco, and they talk about how these jobs are paying, I think, like $150,000, $160,000 a year. And so somebody just pointed out, if they solve the problem of homelessness, then they work themselves out of a job. And so it's like the incentive alignment or misalignment. There is an incentive misalignment. Is that kind of what you're referring to? Some other examples of that maybe?
Well, you just at a philosophical level, how do you measure success and development? Basically, just as you noted, you work yourself out of a job, but no one wants to lose a job, not even people in development. Yeah. They have mortgages and that kind of thing. Yeah. Now, I'm not saying that they're people who, although I do believe it is the case in some situations, they're not mercenary about it.
Yeah.
They might feel like they're really essential and making it, an important contribution to the community. But what you're dealing with oftentimes is a lot of, counterproductive effort. And a lot of there's kind of an ongoing infusion of resources into the community, but the community never really develops in such a way so as to sort of carry forward its own work. So let's just think about, can we think of in your audience there may be somebody who can identify a nation that is a success story economically because it was the product of what we're talking about, economic development, but I can't think of one. If you think about, say, Japan or say South Korea, let's think about South Korea. South Korea, in the 1950s was a basket case.
Yeah.
Poverty, orphans everywhere, all the kinds of stuff. Now, the problem that South Korea is dealing with today is the problem of prosperity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there are a lot of problems still in South Korea, but they're a very different character. But the result, sort of the problems we're dealing with now are the results of economic development and economic development that occurred because there was an there were investments that were made in that part of the world by various investors who were looking to turn a profit.
Yeah,
they weren't engaged in economic development as a charity. They were engaged in economic development as a business venture. And the people there had the wherewithal to make good use of the resources that came their way, and they did an excellent job, in many respects. So that's economic development. What we see in many places in the world, Haiti would be a good example. It's just it's just nuts.
They're getting tens of millions of dollars, if not probably billions, and just complete mismanagement. It's no better off than they were when they were there. It's all, again, we're finding out via this USAID stuff, which I think is what spurred on your initial tweet. Like, we're finding out just how much kickbacks and all this kind of stuff that was going on.
Yeah, so as I mentioned in another tweet, I think I identified five basic types of people that I can remember in the world of economic development. The first are the naive, and the evangelical world just seems to have an endless supply of such people, yep. and they just keep throwing those people out there to work in these organizations, yep. and then the quixotic. I would characterize the stuff I was involved with. In is quixotic. In other words, I had some things that I was trying to accomplish that were almost impossible to accomplish because of certain things that were sort of on the ground. But I tried hard for a few years and then kind of threw in the towel. Then you have crooks, people who were just on the make, and those are the genuine poverty pimps. Those are the people who are using poverty to pursue their own personal agenda. And then you've got the ideologically captured. I mean, those are the bitter people. Those are the people who just hate success. They hate capitalism. They hate you name it. And then you've got the saints, and that's the smallest group. There are some real saints out there who just are in it for the long haul, whose capacity, you know, their ability to, you know, when we think about the fruit of the Spirit, long suffering. I mean, these are people who just know how to stick around for the long haul and just keep at it, even though situation often seems hopeless. But there are people out there like that, and I've known a few, and I admire them.
Yeah, I admired them as well, and I think we need definitely more of them. I can't remember who I was talking to about this, but I think it was my mother-in-law, because she was saying something about doing jury duty, and so I had had this conversation with a few other people, and about every single Christian I talked to, they talk about, I got chosen for jury duty. All I need to do is go in there and tell them that I'm against abortion and whatever, and then I'll get kicked out and I won't have to go through jury duty. And I'm like, okay, listen, I understand that. But then you see somebody like a Daniel Penny, you know, this guy who saves someone's life and then gets this crazy jury where he could have easily gotten in New York City, like could have easily gotten sentenced to death, you know, or jail or, you know, whatever. And I'm just like, we need more Christians who are willing to, you know, to do the hard thing and the annoying thing and be in these places. Because, again, if I was in that situation, I would want somebody, you know, somebody to be there. So, yeah, I think another thing as you're looking at, again, some of these success stories, right? Because one of the ones that you hear a lot on, you know, when you talk to people on the left is like, well, look at the Nordic countries. You know, look at them, you know, look at how they're able to just give so much money. You know, these people, it's just incredible. And I mean, can you speak to that? Like, what are some of the misconceptions, you know, that you see that, you know, people are like, people are just blind to, you know, maybe the reality of what's undergirding it and how that's actually happening?
Well, I guess I'd have to look into what they're getting at. I mean, if we think about the Nordic countries, you know, there is a significant sort of cultural, inheritance that they possess that it makes it possible for them to order their culture well and have profitable enterprises. And and I've been told too that the spin that you hear from the left is not really an accurate representation of what you actually have going on there. Yeah. They actually have pulled back on many of their social welfare schemes just because they were undermining their business and profitable ventures and that kind of stuff. But anyway, when I think about the Nordic countries having surplus that they can share with us, I think that's fine. I mean, it's great. I'm not thinking about that. I'm thinking about basket case countries that just receive on the receiving end that can't seem to benefit from what is being provided. So there's a lot of resources that are pouring in. Now it is true that, you know, in some cases you've got loans and so forth, and you've got this kind of scenario that I think is really well presented in that documentary Poverty Inc. I don't know if you've ever had a chance to see that, but essentially that's an expose kind of getting at some of the dynamics that we're talking about here. So an example, people love to give clothing away and it empties the closet, makes it possible to buy new stuff. But then, you know, the clothing goes into the container that's by the church or whatever, you know, for Salvation Army, what have you. But the stuff that gets sent overseas, what ends up happening is local industry that might have you know, sort of the prospect of actually producing clothing for native populations is just kind of undercut because how do you compete with free? And so you have, I had this explained to me the other day, the reason why you go to many African countries and they've got T-shirt celebrating the loser of the Super Bowl. It's because the T-shirts were printed ahead of time.
Yeah.
and they didn't know who was going to win, and so they got to do something with the T-shirts that said that the loser won.
Yeah.
And so this gets sent over to Africa. So, you know, what does that do for like cottage industries, you know, people who are making clothing? Now, you can say, well, yeah, there's still native dress and so forth, but I think people get what I'm getting at. It's not hard to understand how that's counterproductive.
Yeah. The other example of that was Tom's shoes. They did this, those little shoes where they basically, it was buy one, get one, or buy one, give one. They would, if you bought a pair, they would give someone, and it just devastated the shoe industry in Argentina and. So yeah, all these unintended consequences that you do see.
The question I've got is why didn't people see them? Are we that stupid that we don't realize that throwing a bunch of free stuff into a sort of developing economy kind of undercuts the entrepreneurial spirit and prevents, you know, sort of homegrown things from developing? Why are we so stupid?
Yeah. And well, I think there's obviously there's probably a bunch of answers to that. I think one of the things is just genuinely the popular level economic education. I mean, I wasn't taught anything in high school. I didn't, maybe a little bit in college, but like if you're not studying economics, and then even those, you can be twice the son of hell. there's a lot of Keynesian economics, you know, where you're learning awful, untrue, ungodly things about the nature of economics and how the world works. So I think that's a big part of it is we're just, you know, very poorly educated, if educated at all. We'll look at this is part one of your tweet series here. You said poverty pimping. Okay, let's look at this. So I first heard the term poverty pimp at a talk given by someone with years of experience working in the blighted districts of Washington, D.C. It was the early 1990s, and I was just getting started with an urban ministry I had founded in Boston. He didn't explain it, but I knew intuitively what he meant, the phrase poverty pimping. He wasn't speaking necessarily about pimps like Al Sharpton. He meant that any one of us might become a pimp, someone who built a nonprofit or a personal reputation or even a handsome income by using the misery of other people to do so. Poverty firsthand. So let's just stop there. Can you kind of unpack more about that story? So you're going down there with all the good intention in the world, which I think you both would acknowledge this is a big part of the thing, is people just have good intentions and they think that their good intentions baptize whatever the actual action is that they're, putting into play.
Well, the pimping can work in different ways. One of the ways is when you sort of focus in on the misery of people and use that to tug the heartstrings. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I swore I would never do is publish any image of somebody that person mm-hmm. would be embarrassed to have sort of distributed. So, of course, when we think about a situation, say like a famine and we see children who are suffering, that's one thing. But if we're looking to, really have a long-term positive impact on a community, you don't want to humiliate the people that you're supposed to be helping. You wouldn't want, if you felt embarrassed to share a photo that you're using to raise money with the people in the photo, then you've done something that is, not just questionable, but wrong.
Well.
So what I would want to do is say any photos that we have of people that we're working with, we'd want them to be proud to be depicted the way that they're being depicted. But that really constrains your ability to raise funds because, if somebody looks at a person in a photograph and you say, hey, this is Jeremy, and this is his high school graduation picture. He looks great, doesn't he? Yeah, we're working with him, by the way. People are like, well, he does look great. Why should I give you any money? So there's that. But the other side of it is very often that the tail wags the dog in that world because one of the sources of income for many of these ministries are the foundations. And the foundations don't just say, send us your proposals. We'll fund anything that sounds reasonably, helpful. They'll say, no, these are the things we're trying to do.
Yeah.
You need to make certain that whatever you do tickles our, or scratches our itch. So that's one of the ways that a lot of the ministries kind of get co-opted, because, you know, foundations like Lilly or Pew or, you know, whatever, for whatever, you know, they're all putting out and say, this is the, these are the things that we, so people wonder, why is all this transgender weirdness and why is all this gender fluidity stuff kind of like seeped into all, well, that's, there you go.
Yeah.
You know, even ostensibly Christian ministries have gotten co-opted that way.
Yeah. And then, I mean, the same thing with like climate change. Again, if you're like, that's one of the reasons why on the investing front, because like, I mean, that's another place you see all these same things work out is, you know, the governments create incentives and they say, hey, we'll give you these tax breaks if you invest in this way. And so just that's driving, you know, that's driving so much of the incentives of what's going on. We saw this as missionaries. We were, you know, we were church planters in Uruguay. And I mean, we had, it's crazy, we had very similar convictions. Like when we, it took us 3 years to raise all of our support because we refused to just ask people, like we kind of just shared the need and kind of, you know, told them what we were going to do. And then just, you know, didn't directly ask people. We just trusted that the Lord would bring him. And then once he did bring him, we had almost no loss of support, like throughout our time there. So, but then, yes, the same thing with pictures. We just refused to send pictures, you know, of people we were ministering to. And again, we had people we knew and loved who, you know, that they were kind of confused by that. So I think it is though. It's one of those things where, yeah, these are actual real people. Like these aren't, you know, these aren't just, this isn't a famine, this isn't whatever. And
yeah. And if, you know, I think it's pretty easy to understand if you were to say, you know, I just got out of bed and I look really bad or I'm sick. I don't want a photo right now. And then someone says, no, we got to take that photo of you because it'll really bring in the money. You know, they won't say it that way, but that's kind of the thing that's at work.
Yeah. So you get there, you go to this, you know, conference and this guy starts talking and, you know, kind of how did it work out from there?
Oh, well, he was a decent guy. But in terms of my own thinking up with regard to that, it just confirmed a suspicion that I had that this is a problem, that the incentives are all sort of backwards and weird. And the things that work don't help you sort of fund, you know, the things that are the measure of success. So how do you measure success in the nonprofit world? Do you measure success by we had to sort of pare things back because there wasn't as much need as there used to be? You know, we laid off a bunch of people because, you know, we had the money, but there was no need to keep them on board because the thing that they were doing is, you know, they were successful.
Sure. Sure.
You know,
yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, so the incentives are all kind of weird and backwards. And generally what will happen is maybe if a need changes, and often the needs change not because of this the organization's success, but because of the larger macroeconomic factors that are in play. So for example, you know, I know it's hard to believe, but in the 1970s, Times Square was like a pit. It was like a cesspool. It was like a place. Now you might feel that is that way today, just because of the stuff that's on the big billboards and stuff, and light shows. But what I'm getting at is that it was a place that people who were, you know, tourists didn't want to go. Oh, it's just a place that you could get mugged or be propositioned by a sure. prostitute. I remember walking through in the early 80s and like every block, I was propositioned by a prostitute.
Yep.
And there was some guy trying to sell me stolen goods. You know, it was just that way. Now you go there and, you know, it's some of the most valuable real estate in America and the world. And there were ministries that were there that either moved and followed the poverty or just completely sort of changed their whole way of going about their work and are no longer sort of urban ministry in the old classical sense. So what I'm getting at is that generally that those are the dynamics that are really in play. And when it comes to the ministries that I identified as being really good and solid and successful, nobody outside those communities knows about them. So this is the other thing. If you're getting a lot of like mail, it's probably an indicator that that the people in the community are not supporting it.
Wow.
And I can think of churches, León de Judá, for example, in Boston, which is obviously a Spanish-speaking church. Yeah. Just the pastor there was a Harvard grad, really sharp guy. And they didn't need anything. I can think of black churches in places like Philadelphia, Christian Stronghold Baptist Church, who just are just a dynamic, powerful ministries where they are really are seeing lives changed, but it's not because they're playing the poverty pimping game. Yeah. It's because they're actually working with people and doing the things that make a difference. And this is one of the things that makes a difference. And we all kind of know this, but the ideologically captured cannot reconcile themselves to it. And that is fathers make the difference.
Yeah.
Fathers make the difference. So in, you know, difficult circumstances, tough neighborhoods, if your dad is home and he's on the job and doing what he should do, generally speaking, that's a family where we see upward mobility and education emphasized and kids doing well and stuff like that. It doesn't matter what ethnic group it is, wherever dad is home and he's investing himself in his wife and kids, things are working generally pretty well.
Yeah.
And but the ideologues can't accept that because they despise patriarchy.
Yeah, it's kind of what you described before. It's like you self-select. Like the people who would actually be beneficial to your cause, you know, politically they're untenable, or, you know, again, faith-wise, oh, these are Christians, you know, those are, so like you're self-selecting away from, you know, people who could actually prevent a lot of this stuff. It reminds me a lot of the situation up until this year with the health industry in the United States. Like so much of it is, you know, trying to do fixing stuff after the fact, which is much more expensive, which is much more drastic, rather than just doing, you know, prevention. You know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure or something like that. So I think there's a lot of parallels there. You mentioned social workers, you mentioned, like, you know, growing up and seeing this. What were some of the other, you know, people that you encountered where kind of you saw this even from like a younger age?
You mean kind of the
grifting,
that kind of stuff. Well, yeah, it was just that kind of that way. Now, it wasn't all negative. I can remember a particular situation when I was in junior high, and I had a guidance counselor who was kind of an old hippie. So I think his name was Jim, but he called me into his office one day and he said, you're never in school, your grades are terrible, but your IQ test is kind of strong, so what's going on? So he kind of went outside the lines and got me a job at a pharmacy before I was old enough to legally be employed.
Oh, wow. Child labor, oh my goodness. There's the thought.
Right. That's right. And it was fun. I mean, it was kind of a shady outfit too. but the experience was a positive one, but the idea that he saw something in me that was positive, in other words, he saw what I could do rather than focus on my I guess needs or whatever. So I think that's really important thing to important principle is that I think the organizations, the people, you know, who make a difference in those communities are people who really do see the upside in people, not just simply the desperation. And if you really see the upside, you expect a return. It's not as though you just sort of pump resources in and just walk away. You know, you expect something to not return to you, but to larger, you know, community, to God, you know, and so forth. So people, when they are defined as just simply human sort of like ciphers who just kind of suck in everything.
Yeah, consumers. Yeah.
Consumers of social services or whatever. That's a dehumanizing sort of thing to experience. And I watched it. I mean, I witnessed it. So a lot of this kind of the attitude, sort of the cynicism that I had, wasn't something that I acquired when I got into urban ministry. It was something that I already possessed. So it was kind of a not inoculation, you know, so I could, I, you know, even though at certain points I was entertaining intellectually certain things just to sort of, you know, what is it with this particular school of thought, like liberation theology? I was always a bit skeptical just because the emphasis on those schools when it came to, you know, political solutions or redistribution schemes and stuff like that.
Yeah, really. I mean, it really is a different, it's a different anthropology. Like, it's, you know, looking at people as if they're primarily consumers rather than, you know, stewards, creators. You know, like, this is like God is a creator God. So he right. You know, takes things and then, you know, obviously he can create with his words. And but like, he created us to take this raw materials of the world. And then obviously even down to having kids, like, we take these things that we're entrusted with and we try to multiply them. We try to, you know, not just add and subtract. We try to multiply. We're called to do that. And so I think that represents a humongous difference, you know, between the way that people who aren't Christians look at the world and look at, you know, the people around them. Again, it is a very dehumanizing thing. I agree. It's easy to treat people like they're machines, you know, and that poverty is just as if we just have the right processes, then right. If we just get the right resources to the right place, it's like, no, that's not how people work. Like, people need to be discipled. They need people who care about them to take an interest and spend time with them. It's not simply enough to, you know, if we just put the right inputs, we'll get the right things out of it. It just doesn't work that way.
Yeah. And I think often the kind of the missing dimension to these efforts is the household. And that's one of the reasons why I spent, you know, the time that I did developing my thinking in that particular matter. Yep. So there's a direct connection between my experience as a kid, my time in, you know, working in urban ministry, and then, you know, the things I've written about and have become known for. But when you're dealing with the development crowd, they just do a dance around the household. They don't want to concede that a healthy household would basically address all the things that they think need to be addressed.
Yeah.
And without the kinds of, dependencies that a lot of folks have. So, to give you a little bit of further background, my mother was very much a leftist, and she had some challenges in life, some difficulty and so forth, but she was one of these people who just, you know, is kind of the poster child for, you know, the drugged out single mom. And, you know, when I would watch sort of the story play out, she died. I'm actually older than she was when she died.
Well,
as I watched sort of the story play out, obviously, you know, I have affection for her. I have affection for her. At the same time, I was also kind of appalled at the dependency that she, would describe, you know, basically her way of thinking about the world. It was just like, there's always some guy in a white jacket who's going to take care of this particular situation, who's got a clipboard or whatever. And so anyway, if I were to look at, you know, her thinking about life, I'd almost say that I'm the polar opposite just based on watching her.
Yeah.
If nothing else, although I think there were other things that were in play.
Yeah, one of the things it makes me think of is, and again, this is like, I would argue like a more feminine way to look at the world, just as a general thing, is like arguing from the exceptions to make the rule. You know, like you're like, well, you know, the household. I mean, like there's obviously there's men who abuse their wives and their kids, and you're just like. Right. Okay, granted, but that does not in any way mean that in the vast majority of cases, which don't have those things, that this is not a much better and, you know, produces a lot better outcomes. But it's like they can't, it's like there's an inability or an unwillingness to recognize those things. And I think this is, again, a broader thing, an unwillingness to look at rules and like to consider that there are these general truths that we ought to lean into. Like, obviously, no one is saying that you don't need to address these, you know, these
sure.
abnormal cases where you do have an awful man or, you know, or an awful parents or whatever. But again, I think that I just think the moral reasoning. I think another thing that we don't understand is just the role of government. I think we're in like this, you know, we talked about this at the conference. We're in this moment of definitional crisis where nobody knows what anything is because we've, you know, taken ourselves away from submission to you know, somebody who could authoritatively tell us. And so I think that just, again, what was your, I mean, I really do feel like the average person just looks at government as if they're designed to be there to solve all their problems.
Right.
And it's just such a, I mean, can you speak to, is that how you kind of grew up? Like, I mean, I don't know exactly what years you're growing up. I'm not trying to, you know, out your age here, but yeah. I just feel like that's got to, it seems much more predominant today than it did maybe 50 years ago, 40 years ago.
Well, I'm 62.
Okay.
So
okay.
I know.
Let's see. Yeah.
So I was born in 1962.
62. So, okay. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So I experienced, you know, life in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and so forth. But my my earliest memories are of the 60s, and my father was actually an academic. So we lived in the close proximity to college campuses. I remember the hippies. I remember all that stuff. We had, before my family broke up, we would actually have roomers, you know, people rooming with us who were hippies. Okay. Yeah. So I remember those days pretty well. But in terms of my own, in terms of the political, environment, there was, you know, talking about the war on poverty in the 1960s, there was a process over the course of my childhood and teen years where there was just this kind of metastasizing, you know, in terms of the government's involvement in various features of our lives. And it just seemed to be kind of a... looked at almost as a messianic, in a messianic way, that this is all going to address, you know, we're going to actually wage war on poverty and we're going to beat it and that kind of stuff. And then they would do all this crazy counterproductive stuff. Because as I noted, many of the people who are in that world don't really like business and don't really like business people and don't like basically, you know, the rules and the consequences for, you know, not conducting your business in a profitable way. So one of the things about business is that if you don't turn a profit, or if you just don't even like pay the bills, you know, in other words, as kind of have a subsistence kind of thing, that you're actually, you know, finishing the year at zero, you're out of business.
Yeah.
In other words, you fail. So failure is possible in real economic development.
Yeah.
So, but when it comes to the faux economic development that we're talking about here, it's almost the reverse. If failure is success, because now you can, you know, make a pitch for more money.
Yeah.
Because we didn't get the job done, and we never do.
Yeah. Yeah. And then again, you're always, it's such an unhealthy way. Again, this is why I've thought about this in relation to Christian missions and funding Christian missions. Like, obviously there is a place, you know, we see the Apostle Paul, like there is a place for depending on others, you know, to support your ministry. I fully acknowledge that. But at the same time, like there is, especially if you do it for a long time, like it is just, you can just build unhealthy, you know, dependence. And you see even in Paul's life, right? Like, he was willing to work and he had to work because there's, you know, different levels of maturity of the people who are ministering to him. I really think that we're going to see a return to that in the decades ahead. We certainly saw it in Uruguay, where again, as currency devaluation continues to happen, people have less expenditure income and they're forced to turn to a second job or even a third job, you know, to try to make things meet. And so, and again, I think that'll be actually healthy, even if hard in some ways.
Well, you probably remember Roland Allen and the Three Self movement and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yep.
Anyway, he had some good insight there. I mean, I know people have developed it further and, you know, the whole contextualization conversation and all that kind of stuff. But I also think that with Paul and his ability to self-fund, you know, he makes a point of that at different points in the epistles. He says, I didn't take anything from you people.
Yeah.
You saw I was working night and day.
Yeah.
And so he had a trade, he had skills, he could do things like that. I also think that the environment was such that there were a number of sort of success gurus, the sophists, you know, that whole kind of crowd, who were kind of like the Anthony Robbins of their day, you know, just going around trying to wake the giant within and taking just lots of money from people. And I think my suspicion is that Paul, I can't prove this, but just he was savvy. I'm sure he's trying to, one of the things he was trying to get across is that this is a gift from God. It's not something that I own, that I'm selling. that kind of thing. So it's a whole different sort of frame of reference for thinking about the work of the ministry. But when we think about, say, church planting, you know, what's the goal? We want a church that is able to fund its own work, right? Yeah. So getting back to my earlier thoughts, when we think about institutions and their development, the growth of the institution ought to be a net positive for a community. So when we think about, say, a really large and well-funded economic development program that doesn't actually do anything to really change a neighborhood, it just kind of as a vacuum cleaner sucking in funds. And then the people who are on staff, you know, are paid to do these different things that, you know, in a healthy community, you just don't need to have done. But in a healthy community, what do you have? You have businesses that are turning a profit. You have people who are gainfully employed. You've got people who are, you know, investing in their families and investing in their churches. And so churches don't have to justify the existence of a church based on the material poverty of a community.
Yeah.
In other words, the church can be the church in that community in any kind of economic setting.
Yeah.
Right. And this gets me back to my earlier point that the churches that I was really impressed with didn't spend any time trying to raise money from other sources. They were just basically focused on getting, in many cases, men to grow in grace. They were really focused on helping men grow in grace and shoulder their responsibilities as fathers and as husbands and as breadwinners. That was like a huge emphasis in these Black and Hispanic churches.
Can you talk more about that? Like, what form did that take? Was there seminars or something of like learning how to do business development, or like what kind of shape did that take?
Well, there's a little bit of that, but I think most of it was just kind of relational in character and mentoring, you know, really solid guys.
Yeah.
So I remember attending a church in Philadelphia. I mentioned it earlier. It was a Christian Stronghold Baptist Church. And the pastor of that church was a guy named Willie Richardson. I don't know if he's still alive, but this would be in the mid-90s. And he was an impressive dude. One of the themes that he would stress is debt-free living. And so he refused to get the church in debt. So what they did is they would like self-fund. They would buy like a grocery store. They'd self-fund. They renovate it and turn it into a church. And this happened several times for them because the church kept growing.
Kept growing.
Yeah. And I remember they would take the offering. This was fascinating because there was maybe like a 1,500 to 2,000 people in the sanctuary, and they had multiple services. And I witnessed the offering, and the ushers were all dudes, man, who were just jacked. They all had bow ties. They looked like they were like Nation of Islam almost.
Wow.
And they came out, and they would do the march. So it wasn't even like they passed the plates. You had to get up, go down to the front, and then the elders were on the platform watching you give.
Yeah,
and they would just come in there, doom, choom, and just like it was like clockwork, and they were able to accomplish it. I'm not exaggerating, in like maybe, I don't know, 7 minutes, this entire room, because it was just so well done. And but he looked like, as you know, in terms of his own deportment, he looked like he could have been the vice president of Prudential Insurance.
Oh, wow.
And when he got up to talk, he had a very businesslike approach. It was funny. He had what I called the designated whooper. He had this old dude on the platform with him who was gray haired, big beard, you know, old black guy, kind of wiry. And I kind of suspected that at a certain point, this guy was going to get up and start doing his thing. And he did. He just got, woo, and then all the old ladies, you know, got up the hankies. Yeah. It was a great time. But it was definitely a strong emphasis on family life, healthy community, you know, success, you know, serving the Lord through your vocations, you know, and strong stress on men. And that was what I saw as a common theme in the successful urban churches. There was a very strong emphasis on men doing their job.
Yeah, really. I mean, it really is the case, right? Like, there's some statistic about, like, if a kid is the first one to become a Christian in a family, mom and dad are something like 12% more likely to go to church. If the mom becomes, it's something like 20%. But if dad comes, then it's like a 97% that both of his kids, you know, his kids and his wife will come with him. And like, you really do see, just men set the agenda. Like, women, like, you know, women and children want to please their fathers and husbands. Like, they want to be with them. And, right. You know, go ahead.
Well, this is why the ideological capture of evangelicalism is by the left,
yeah,
you know, particularly related to these matters, is such a tragic story.
Yep.
What we see is kind of a drift into low performance and really kind of counterproductive stuff. And I'm just, you know, kind of disgusted by it, frankly. And so, you know, I had some people that I know from back in the day, they're all commiserating the loss of funds from USAID and all kinds of stuff. I'm thinking, no, man, this is one of the best things that could have happened. Because what we need to do is we need to get people like you out of this work.
Yeah.
And what we need to see more of is churches like Leon de Huda and, you know, yep. Christian Stronghold Baptist Church. And we need to see those churches as kind of leading the way. So I remember I had this fun experience. I was in Philadelphia another time, and I was talking to somebody who was in urban ministry. And at that time, there was a character by the name of Tony Campolo. I don't know if that name rings a bell.
Yep.
But Campolo is no longer with us. I think he died here a couple of years ago. But anyway, he was like kind of like in the world of evangelicalism, sort of evangelical publishing and the evangelical mega complex. He represented inner city Philadelphia because he would just talk about, you know, he was kind of lefty. He became a friend of Bill Clinton. You know, I don't know if you remember that, but he was a friend of Bill. Anyway, he kind of went down a road that, you know, is a bad road to go down. But anyway, when I got there, I mentioned Campolo to this guy who was like a veteran in the city. And he said, Tony who? In other words, the point was, he's not making any difference in Philly.
Yeah.
In fact, he's working counterproductively.
Yeah. Gosh, man, it is. It does seem like, you know, you have the people who are actually doing the good work are too humble to talk about it. And so then they're not getting, you know, people either think that stuff isn't happening, or they just assume that these other people who are making more noise,
right?
You know, like the noise, that there's like a you know, a break in the noise to signal ratio, you know, that kind of a thing. It really is frustrating.
And the guys who are doing the work and getting things done, I mean, they don't, you know, they're busy.
Yeah.
They're not like thinking about this problem. They're just thinking about, well, I got to build my church and, you know, get this particular thing done or fire this person who's not doing his job.
Yeah. This, I do have hopes that this is going to be one of the upshots of ChatGPT is, you know, guys who just want to get out there and work, it'll now be easier for them to develop, you know, like whatever, like clips of, you know, their business or something. It'll make marketing a little bit easier for them, hopefully, or something. Well, here, so I've got your part two. So I'm going to read a little of these, and I'll let you riff on each of these two each of these 5 points that you put. So point number one here, most of the people I've known, this is your words, most of the people I've known in quote unquote economic development don't believe in wealth creation. They hate capitalism in principle. And for many of them, quote unquote profit is just another word for theft.
People come to mind. I see faces. So I'm not talking about some kind of broad sort of, statement that has no basis in reality. I'm actually thinking of conversations I had with people. So I remember a guy who was actually he was a liberation theology guy. He was a Pentecostal guy in Boston, and in his mind, it was all about redistribution. It was so, you know, they got the kind of the pizza idea, you know, more pizza for you means less for me, that kind of thing. They have no idea that you can actually grow the pizza.
yes.
So if a person and they're often bitter people. Angry people, some of the least pleasant people that you want to be around.
Yeah, this, it makes me think of, this happens, man. I cannot tell you how common this argument is. People talk about, they object to Bitcoin because they say, well, if there's only 21 million Bitcoin, then, you know, you're going to run out. Like, just gonna, and it's just like, they talk about, they compare it to a pizza, and like, you talk about, no, there's 21 million Bitcoin, and then there's 100 million fragments per Bitcoin. And they're like, well, that just, you know, that just makes the pizza. But you're like, no, what are you talking about? Like, that doesn't make any sense. Like, like the fact that there's more slices doesn't change the size of the pizza. Like, you know, like, just, but again, the lack of economic literacy on the part of the average person, and especially, again, people who are, they're good marketers, they're good at gaming the system that is, but they're not good, they're not really intellectually coherent. Well, they're actually smart.
So I've known people who I can say I've created wealth.
Yes.
It wasn't just that they were gaming anything or stealing anything from anybody else. They worked with other people, and they in the process of developing the wealth were bringing some things to the table that those other people didn't have. So, for example, when we think about an entrepreneur is a person who's willing to take some risks that generally other people don't take.
Yeah.
And they're also sort of animated by a vision or an idea that, you know, they're going to be able to create something that people will desire and will have their, you know, potentially improve their lives with. So then there's an exchange, and in the process of a good exchange, both parties are wealthier.
Yeah.
See, that's the thing that people don't get. Yeah. People think that in the process of exchange, somebody else is always going to win, and I'm going to lose. That's stupid. I mean, both in good exchange, both parties, and that's how wealth is generated in a society, when the various members of a community are, working together, and there's an exchange that's going on that enriches both parties.
Yeah, it makes it. So there's the famous passage where Jesus is, that Jesus tells the disciples that it's difficult for the rich to inherit the kingdom, and they're just flabbergasted. They're like, wait, what? Like, then who can enter? Like, if it's hard. And I just have meditated on that passage a ton. I don't know what, but like, what your thoughts are on that. But one of the things, so obviously they had, I mean, their currency devaluation goes through cycles. And so they were, their currency, you can figure out where they were in the process. Like, their currency was being devalued, but it still had, you know, a good amount of silver within it, and good, pretty sound. And so where you have a sound currency, like a scarce sound currency, you basically, the only way to convince people to, you know, or basically the way to earn money is to actually serve people's needs. Like, if you're not just going to outright steal, okay, like, then you actually have to serve your neighbor to get them to part with money that is, you know, more valuable. You actually have to serve them. And so if you think about it within that context, you think about, okay, so how does someone get rich in that context? You actually have to serve your neighbors to a very high degree. And so you can imagine, like, if that's affecting the disciples' thinking, and Jesus tells them that rich people, you know, who they're in their mind, there's a correlation between rich and serving your neighbor. And so the people who are richer have obviously served their neighbors better. And so they're more godly. Like, you can imagine that being kind of like what the level of thinking, where they're associating the reason that they're rich is because God has blessed them, and because they've loved their neighbors. They've fulfilled the great commandment, you know, you could argue. And Jesus goes, no, it's more complicated than that, you know?
Are you familiar with Jerry Boyer? You heard of him?
Yeah. The Makers versus the Takers?
Right. Yeah. So have you had a chance to check it out, that book?
I've read a little bit of it. I haven't read the whole thing.
Essentially, his thesis is that when we look at Jesus' teaching on money, it's important to know where he was physically at the time.
Okay.
And so his point is that Galilee was actually kind of where you saw a lot of entrepreneurial activity.
Really?
And Jerusalem is where you saw a lot of sort of Washington, D.C. kind of corruption.
Got you.
So, when we think about the money changers, now the funny, you know, the interesting thing, something worth thinking about is George Soros is a money changer.
Yeah.
People don't. 100%. Don't, yeah, but I mean, literally, that's how he made his wealth. It was, see.
The pound, yeah.
Yeah, playing games with currency.
Yeah.
And so he's just remarkably creepy in just every way. But I guess, you know, this idea that, you know, Jesus' statements concerning money can be sort of taken out of context, literally, and just applied willy-nilly. That's the thing that Jerry's getting at, is that you have to think about, okay, where did he say that? To who was he referring to? And those kinds of things.
Yeah, it's easy to be to dehumanize scripture and just to snatch words that God has said within a proper context that those details matter. Again, to have your own agenda, you just want to snatch them out and we're going to use them for my own agenda. You know, so perverse.
Where I would like to take kind of left-wing people is to the parable of the talents. So, you know, we've got three dudes.
Yeah.
You know, and one of them is really sharp and the other one's pretty good.
Did you just assume their gender? Oh my gosh, I can't believe you. You're so
That's right. So the first dude, you know, obviously he's got the kind of savvy that he knows how to invest and to reap a return. Yeah. The same with the second. The third guy is actually kind of the left winger. You know, he's basically buried in the ground. You get back what you expect. You know, anyway, so but there are different ways that the Lord demonstrates that he understood some things in sort of the business sphere that I don't think many people in the development world have much interest in.
Yeah, again, it's real easy to snatch out. I mean, we could go a lot of directions with this. You could talk about a lot of the conversation around immigration has right. You know, is guilty of the same thing. Like, it's very zero sum, very, you know.
Well, I think that what we're saying is, you know, getting back to your earlier comment about, say, you know, what was going on in San Francisco with homelessness. So one of the things you can pretty much count on is if you give away free stuff, people show up.
Yeah.
So if you're a community that has a reputation for providing stuff for free, there are like very few requirements in terms of your own conduct or where you live or anything like that, then you can count on a place becoming more and more like Portland or more and more like San Francisco. And the United States basically was saying, hey, we'll give you free stuff. Now it's interesting to see that things are kind of drying up. Is, you know, not only are people being removed, but there are fewer people wanting to move here because they understand that the game is over and there's a different sheriff and things are going to work differently.
Yeah.
And you know, people all around the world are making a living. It's not like this is the only place to make a living.
Yeah, you know, and at the same time, you're like, the currency devaluation, obviously, like almost every other country on earth has experienced multiple currency failures, whereas, you know, by virtue of having the reserve currency, we've been able to, you know, not feel those to the same degree that they have. I think there is, like, that's the thing where I feel like the more that I've understood currency devaluation, the more I'm like, okay, I'm sympathetic to people. But I also recognize, you know, it's like, I also recognize that there's actual processes here that matter. So it's like, you have the sympathy is normally like the left, you know, or at least it's coded, you know, that's the left concern. And then the right concern is basically, well, there's not enough money for everybody. And that's obviously acceptable too. And so this is one of the things that has been super encouraging to me, just being in Bitcoin, is just seeing like somebody like El Salvador, where 4 years ago they adopt Bitcoin. They were, I think, either number one, they were in the top three for sure of immigrants flooding into the United States. They have the combination of, they basically adopt Bitcoin and they start buying a Bitcoin a day for the last 4 years or whatever. And then they get a strong political leader, a male political leader, who basically says this far and no more to criminals. And those two things, bringing law and order and having like a you know, consistent basis, it's not just keeping pace with inflation, it's actually outperforming, it's outpacing inflation. The combination of those two things resulted in turning the tide of immigration. They actually had a larger number of people going back there because they're realizing, hey, we want to be where our families are. We want to be back in our country that we love. And now it's actually safe to be there. And so, like, this is one of, I'm encouraged and I'm like hopeful that as we move to, you know, to scarce currencies, you, whether it's Bitcoin or, you know, if, again, I'm theoretically, at least ideologically open to something like gold, or, you know, as we move back to that, I think we're going to see, you know, some of the, again, these other, as we change the incentives, we're going to change and get healthier outcomes.
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah, good economic policy is important, and political leadership is important. Yeah, I'm all for that. You know, what we see going on in Argentina and El Salvador are very encouraging developments. Hopefully, we'll see some of those same things happening here. But I get it gets back to my earlier point. You know, when it came to, say, South Korea or Japan, neither of those nations became the powerhouses that they have become because of economic development. That they did so because of good political leadership, good economic policy, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, there is no substitute for because again, you can only do so much from a national level. I think you can do more than the average Christian who wants to, you know, who would talk about, oh, we don't want to be involved in politics. You know, like, I think you can accomplish a lot more, especially in correctively, like we're seeing. Yeah, just we're not tired of winning yet. We just keep, you know, seeing wins the last couple of months. I think there's a lot more that the government can do when it's, you know, limiting itself to the scope that God calls it to work according to.
Yeah, I think too that we ought to be spending our time studying success. You know, so poverty studies. Who wants to study poverty? We already know that you know, poverty is a bad thing. What we want to understand is how places like, so when I think about Japan in the 19th century was essentially a medieval society.
Yep.
And then within 80 years, they are threatening the United States as a major player on the world stage.
Yeah.
How did that happen? Mm-hmm. You're just thinking about it. You know, you go from, you know, firing cannons to make them trade to, okay, they're bombing, Hawaii.
Yeah, exactly.
How did this happen? Is it because a bunch of development people went over to Japan and opened up development offices, or was there something else going on? I think the something else is what we want to have a better grasp of. You know, what it made it possible for them to do that? A very patriarchal society, by the way.
Yeah. I don't know if with the specific example of Japan, if this one applies, because again, they're one of the lowest Christian populations in the world. But at least in the case of like South Korea, I think they're like, what you believe about God definitely affects how you see the rest of your life, and including economics. And so I think it has been interesting, right, to see the limiting factor on something like the growth of China's economy has been their unwillingness to basically embrace free markets. They've tried to open themselves up as much, you know, like to a point, but they're just not willing to go full bore. And so I don't see any realm in which, or any situation in which, they're going to be able to fully, you know, get to the level of success that the United States have without that willingness to do.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yep. So you got your last point here. So we've already talked about two of the other ones that are the next two in line. So the last one says outsiders who, so these are just basically people who can help this. So outsiders who support the idea of economic development tend to have only one category, the last one. So if you're basically making, you have people who are in politics making the case, they're pretending that of the five, you know, categories, that the saints are the only one. Oh, if you're not in favor of this, you're just a hater. You know, we're all just saints out here, right? Is that kind of what you're getting?
No, that's exactly it. Yeah, and very often not people who are on the outside, who don't have sort of the inside, you know, sort of insider knowledge that I was trying to sort of play out in terms of the five types. That's exactly the idea. So if you say, oh, I work with the poor and whatever, then immediately you're assumed to be a saint.
Yeah. So where does this, I mean, where does this look like in terms of, I mean, maybe you can kind of speak to maybe a little bit of, I guess, maybe in Battleground, what does this look like in terms of the community there? What does it look like to, you know, to try to put some of these things into practice? Like, obviously those are the negative examples, but what are some examples of things that you guys are positively, you know, doing, again, to give people a positive vision that they can take back home and think about and start meditating on?
Well, Battleground is a remarkably healthy place in terms of families, in terms of businesses, and so forth. So when it comes to the kind of destitution that you see in sort of places like, Chicago, you know, on the South Side, or the West Side, or Detroit, or something like that, or St. Louis, you just don't see that here in Battleground. Now, you just can go down the street a little bit and get into Portland and see plenty of it. But there's a kind of a health here that you don't see in those places. And that health has to do with, you know, families being strong, churches being strong. We've got, Battleground is probably the most church community I've ever lived in. I mean, we've got large churches in this area and really good ones. We don't have, I think we have one mainline church in the entire vicinity of Battleground. And it's the Methodists, of course, and they've got their rainbow thing going on. But they're a small, pitiful outfit. And I attribute it to the fact that Battleground really didn't start growing until the mid-90s. So even though it was a town that was incorporated, I think, in the 50s, it's kind of hovered around like maybe just 3,000 or 4,000 people forever. And it just kind of took off in the 90s. And by that time, the mainline churches had stopped starting new churches. It just
gotcha.
So all the churches that have been planted in Battleground are evangelical and conservative in one form or another.
Wow. And so how did, again, this is a little bit off topic, but like what did the foundation of the town look like? You said it was founded in the 50s?
Well, it was incorporated in the 50s. The name Battleground actually goes back to a battle that was supposed to happen but didn't, which is kind of a funny thing. There was a Native American group that had decided they were tired of being told what to do by Uncle Sam. And then Uncle Sam said, no, you're going to do what we say. And then they said, okay, we're going to have this battle. And so they established the battleground.
Oh, God.
And before the battle could be fought, they reconciled and everybody, well, there was one fatality and it was a mistake.
So who is the battle between? It was the government and...
Yeah, it was the United States Army and one of the tribes in the area.
Native. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And so then go ahead.
But so that was the name of the area, Battleground. And it just kind of was a place where people, you know, it was kind of an exurb of the greater Portland area.
Okay.
And it just has really taken off in the last 20 years in terms of its growth. It's become a real kind of... dynamic area, so lots of people moving here.
Are they moving there from all around the country, or are they kind of escaping Portland and the godlessness in that area?
It's a bit of both. Yeah, it's a bit of both. Yeah.
Okay, and so what are some of the things beyond it just being a productive, healthier place? I'm sure that makes your job easier as a pastor and as somebody who's got businesses and stuff, but like, what are some of the things that you as a church and as a pastor, either in this specific congregation or maybe in the past, have done to try to cultivate some of the these proactive things that you're seeing? Have there been any like examples maybe that just come to mind?
Well, I think that we have a very strong entrepreneurial character to our church. We've got entrepreneurs in the congregation who are very successful and hire and employ many people in the church, but also in the larger area.
Yep.
And we have a kind of a growing footprint in terms of the businesses that are owned by people in the congregation in the Battleground area. So our church is viewed as a really significant contributor to even the political scene here.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And then obviously, I mean, one of the other things, if people aren't Canon Plus subscribers, I know you guys do like one or two conferences a year. What is that?
Yeah. Generally a couple conferences a year. We do our Trad Dad conferences, which, is what they sound like. And then often some theme or topic that we want to talk about or have addressed, and that becomes the basis for a conference. So we did something with Joel Salatin a couple years back. So it was the Food Freedom Conference, and it was actually through that conference that Canon got in touch with Joel that led to his documentary.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. Was John Moody out there for that too?
Yep, John.
Yep.
Of course, John is like Joel's right-hand man.
Yeah.
So Joel is kind of the personality, and John is the guy behind the scenes making everything happen.
Yeah, John's a friend. He came and spoke at the conference, and then we chat pretty frequently. Yeah. What else was I going to ask you? Something along those lines. So you did the Food Freedom Conference. What was the one from this past year?
Well, we've done a couple of trad dabs. We did another one on Negative World. That was with Aaron Wren. So that was a well attended conference. We did one. Well, the latest trad dab was on the fertility crisis. So we had that was the theme, sort of population decline and what's going on with that.
That was November of this past year.
Yeah. And then we've done stuff. We're going to be probably doing some more stuff with Michael Foster. So Michael is actually a friend, and we've been talking about doing some things that kind of build on his project, you know, the county before country stuff.
Love it. Well, cool. Well, Pastor Wiley, thank you so much. Really appreciate you and you taking the time to do this. I'll just, give you the last word. Is there anything you wanted to share about where people can find your work? Again, I'm still pushing for someday to get some more C.R. Wiley artwork available. I'd love to fill my walls with the... Actually, is the Daisy book out yet?
No. I just kind of chip away at that a little bit at a time.
Gotcha.
But that's... I need to get it done. I got 5 granddaughters, and they're all getting to be... You know, probably in a couple of years, they'll be ready for it. They're not ready for it yet.
Gotcha.
But I need to finish that up. But yeah, I mean, I write. So I've got a book I'm working on right now on artificial intelligence, and that'll be... finished by the end of June. That's when the deadline is. But I've got like 3 other books I've got kind of in the works.
is it crwiley.com?
I never put anything there unless a new book has come out. But people can, if they want to stay in touch with me, there's social media, but there's also the theology podcast.
It is one of my favorite podcasts to listen to. I mentioned it when I went on the episode that I recorded with you guys. I was like, it felt like I walked through the back of the wardrobe into Narnia. I stumbled into my favorite place in the world. Really appreciate you. You guys are doing great work. Go support them. Go subscribe, listen, buy the books. Search for Pastor Wiley's books on Amazon. You'll be blessed. I appreciate you, and we'd love to chat with you soon.
Yes, sounds great. Thanks, George. Appreciate it.
This episode of the TGFB podcast is presented by River. River's the best and most secure place to buy Bitcoin in the United States. You can head over to river.com/TGFB to set up an account today, and you'll be able to DCA into Bitcoin without paying any fees. The river.com/learn tab is one of the best places to find helpful learning materials and videos that help explain what Bitcoin is, how it works. They have a bunch of other features as well. You can give people Bitcoin via River links. You can be able to send and receive Bitcoin over the Lightning Network and be able to set limit orders. If you want to buy Bitcoin or sell Bitcoin at a particular price, either above or below where it is now. There's also the ability to leave cash in your River account and earn 3.8% paid out in Bitcoin. Go to river.com/TGFB, set up your account in minutes today. Go support those guys.